Great to see y'all here in Kennett, and I want to say hey to everybody in Jennersville who's joining us via live stream this morning. It's wonderful to see everybody. You're here. I take it that means your pipes didn't froze and your car started, right? So anyway, it's great to see y'all. Thanks so much for being here. I have two opportunities to share with you today, and the first one is an upcoming conversation that you could be a part of, Conversations on Race. Most everyone that's a part of our church family will know that this is something that we care deeply about and that we are intentionally giving ourselves to. We want to be agents of racial harmony and reconciliation. God willing, we'd like to see our church diversify over time. This is going to be a decade-long process, but we want to connect meaningfully with the diverse world in which we live. And it all starts with like conversation with relationships. It's why our big goal this year is make new friends. We asked God if we could have the privilege last year, last ministry season, God, would you give us like 100 people to baptize? It's not about the number. It's about the person. But we put a target out there. And God did exceeding abundantly beyond all we asked or imagined. So we're like, okay, this year, how about we make 1,000 new friends? You know, how about every single one of us, would God open a door for us to connect and become friends with somebody who might be different from us? And that might be ethnically, racially, intergenerationally. Any kind of harmony and reconciliation starts with conversation, with friendship, with relationship. And we want to give you an opportunity to build that through some conversations on race. Now, what this is going to be, as you can see on the slide, we have 10 homes. It's going to be a 4-session conversation. There will be a little bit of, you know, input sort of teaching just to stimulate things. And then it's just about being around tables in homes and talking together. And diversity is already baked in. Okay, so like I'm a host for one of the conversations, but I've got some of my new and growing friends who are not Anglo who are going to be a part of it. So it wouldn't do so much good to have like, you know, 12 white people sitting around talking about race. We want to have diversity kind of cooked in, baked in. And so anyway, what you can do is after the service today, go to our website. And you can see the list of when all the conversations are taking place. There might be sort of a rolling start here. Some will probably get started within about 2 weeks. Others might wait until February to get started. We want to give time for people to sign up. And I'll be talking a little bit more about this next week, by the way, because next week is Vision Sunday. We're just going to give the sermon time to what is the vision that God's putting before us for 2017. So we would love to have as many people as possible be a part of this. We'd love to have all of these homes like really busting at the seams so that maybe you have to even make 2 groups within the home when it comes to conversation time. So that's an opportunity for you. We encourage you to avail yourselves of that. You'll see, by the way, when you sign up, that there's just sort of a time and a community. It might be, you know, like, you know, Thursday at 2 in the afternoon, you know, in Hokesson. Not that many people will show up, but, you know, you can say, oh, I actually have Thursday at 2 p.m. free and sign up, and then the host will get in touch with you and give you all the details, okay? So actually, all the times are more convenient than that. So that's one opportunity. The second opportunity is today we get to hear from Dr. Sung Chan Ra. He is professor of church growth and evangelism at North Park Seminary in Chicago. He is, if you're interested, Korean by background, but he comes to Chicago by way of Boston, Baltimore, and ultimately Korea, moved here with his family when he was very young. And Dr. Ra is married to his wife, Sue. He has a 16-year-old daughter named Anna and a 13-year-old son named Elijah. He's somewhat educated. He has degrees from Columbia, from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, from Harvard, and he just added a second doctorate from Duke. Okay? So if he doesn't strike you as the brightest bulb, you know, you'll forgive him for that. But besides all of his incredible learning and intelligence, Dr. Ra is also down to earth enough to enjoy like anything superhero with his 13-year-old son. Could be movies, could be TV shows. Now, would you be more like Iron Man or Captain America? Iron Man. Okay, see, that tells you something about a person. I like Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm looking forward to the second one coming out soon. Not only does he enjoy that, but he's a big baseball fan. And one of the great things about it is, you know, he moved from Baltimore to Boston, and they won a World Series. He moved from Boston to Chicago, and the Cubs won the World Series. So that's why right before the service, I actually offered him the position of preschool ministry director, and he's considering it. So anyway, would you welcome Dr. Ra?
Much. Thank you. Thank you so much. So glad to be here. Go Phillies. Let's bring the pennant back. I'm honored to be here. I'm thankful for the tremendous courage of your pastors, Pastor Greg, Pastor Jim, to talk about some difficult issues. I think in Christianity, we can get into patterns of behavior where we're kind of satisfied with the status quo. And to deal with difficult topics and conversations is not an easy task. So as you're preparing to have a series of conversations in this church about probably one of the most difficult conversations to have, the topic of race, I want to applaud that kind of courage and that kind of willingness to engage that. And I would challenge you, especially as we go through the topic today, to stay with it and to not give up, even though it is a difficult thing. I was a pastor for 17 years, pastored on campuses, and I was a church planter. I've done a lot of different types of ministry. I haven't done preschool yet, but I have done youth ministry, and I've done college ministries, and was a senior pastor for a number of years. So for 17 years, I was a pastor, but for the last 10 years, I've been a professor at a seminary. And when I was a pastor, I was very much an extrovert. I love standing in the back of the church and meeting everybody, getting to know everybody's names, and that was just kind of, it energized me. But when I shifted to starting to teach at a seminary, something biological, physiological, psychological happened to me. And I stopped being an extrovert, and I almost went completely in the other direction and became much more of an introvert. And some of that is just the task of being a professor. You spend a lot more time in your office reading books and writing books. And so that task has meant that I'm much more of an introvert. Now, where that has showed up the most, because I don't pastor anymore, I do more work in the seminary, is when I go in to conferences or I speak at conferences. My introverted tendencies now really start to show up. So when I was a pastor, I go to conferences, I want to meet everybody, talk to everybody, have lunch and breakfast with everybody. But now when I go to conferences, my introverted side kicks in, and I look for the quietest room and try to hide from people during the entirety of the conference after I do my workshop or I do my plenary session. So this happened to me at a major evangelical conference a few years ago. It was about 4,000 to 5,000 people, but I just kind of went into my introvert mode, found it was on a major church campus, a huge sanctuary, but they had this little trailer way on the outskirts of the campus. So I went out there and I found a little space, and I wanted to hide away from people and not be a part of this conference. But the Lord moved me, and the way he moved me was I really had to go to the bathroom. And so I had to leave the trailer because it didn't have a bathroom. So I'm now rushing to the sanctuary. And it's one of those churches where what's happening in the service is so important that the sound is transmitted into the bathroom. I don't know if that happens here, but I'm in the bathroom. I'm like, wow, there's a sermon in this bathroom right now. So I'm hearing the sermon in the bathroom. And the sermon was really intriguing to me because the pastor or the speaker was saying, the sky is the limit. So reach for the stars. I said, that's kind of an interesting mantra to think about. I wonder where he's going with this. The next line was, sky is really the limit. So keep reaching for those stars. And I kept waiting for the next step of this, the Bible to come up at some point, the Jesus' name to come up at some point. And I wasn't in the bathroom for that long, but it was long enough to understand that that was pretty much the entirety of this prominent evangelical leader's message. The sky is the limit. So keep reaching for those stars. And I left that kind of entire conference feeling a little bit discouraged. That at this very important evangelical pastors conference where 4,000 to 5,000 pastors are gathering, the main message was about triumphalism, was about going out and conquering the world, not with the power of Jesus, because Jesus' name stopped being mentioned after a while, but with our own strength, with our own sense of exceptionalism and our own sense of authority, we were supposed to go out and conquer the world, this strong sense of triumphalism. And I realized that there are parts of the biblical narrative that does talk about victory and triumph, but there are important parts of the biblical narrative that talk about suffering and struggle. And we have to have both of those stories in order to understand the full gospel of Jesus Christ. The way I've kind of worked through this is that for 5 years, and this past, in 2015 actually, I released a book on Lamentations. It's a commentary on the book of Lamentations. How many of you have ever read the book of Lamentations? Oh, fantastic. So much further along than most people I know. How many of you heard an entire sermon series on Lamentations? Yeah, that's pretty much right. Maybe one, maybe two of you. Lamentations is kind of an ignored book of the Bible. Not many of us have encountered it. I spent 5 years studying the book. My wife always joked with me and said, you spend 5 years on this book, you're going to sell about 5 copies. Nobody wants a book on the book of Lamentations. Come on. You know, do a book of John or Romans. Everybody will buy that book. Lamentations, nobody's going to buy that book. But I wanted to study the book of Lamentations because it is an ignored book of the Bible. And the practice, the biblical practice of lament, that Lamentations, of course, is a part of, is very much absent in the church in America right now. I'll give you an example of this. Denise Hopkins is an Old Testament scholar in the Washington, D.C. area, and she looks at the genre of lament in the churches that use liturgy. So these would be churches like the Catholic churches, the Episcopalian churches, Lutherans, Methodists, etc., who are guided in their worship life by liturgical texts. So there's actually a book that says, on this day, read this psalm, on this day, preach out of this passage. So they have pretty strict guidelines on what the worship life looks like for these liturgical traditions. But what she found is that many of these churches, when they got to a psalm that was a lament psalm, a psalm that talked about suffering and struggle, those churches just dropped it, left the lament psalm out of their reading, and added a happier psalm instead. So in the liturgical traditions, there is a tendency to kind of shy away from the psalms of lament or stories of lament. There was another study done by Glenn Pemberton, and he was looking at churches that use hymnals in their worship life. And so this would be kind of Baptist and Presbyterian churches that used the hymnals for worship. And what he was discovering was that in the Psalms in our Bible, of the 150 Psalms, 60% of our Psalms are Psalms of celebration or praise, which is all the good things that God has done. You celebrate those good things. But 40% of the 150 Psalms are Psalms of lament that talk about suffering and pain and struggle. But if you look at the typical Baptist hymnal or the typical Presbyterian hymnal, only about 15% of those hymns are Psalms of lament. And the 85% of the songs are songs and hymns of celebration and victory and triumph. But only 15% talk about pain and struggle and suffering. So it is disproportional compared to the Bible, the type of songs we tend to sing. Now, I took that same idea and applied it to the CCLI list. Any of you know what the CCLI list is? CCLI stands for something, something, licensing, something. So what it does is anytime you sing a contemporary worship song and you put it onto the screen, you're supposed to have a little number at the bottom, CCLI number. It's like a 7 to 8 digit number. What it does is it gives you permission, because it's not published in a hymnal or it's not published in a book, to project contemporary worship songs onto the screen so that you can sing them. And then at the end of the month, you're actually supposed to write to CCLI, let them know these are the 20 songs we sang in public. And then they actually keep a list of the top 100 contemporary worship songs that are sung in the United States on a typical Sunday over the course of a year. So, you know, the person who had their song sung in a Sunday service gets, you know, 0.1 cent for the song being sung. So these are licensing for contemporary worship songs. But it keeps a pretty accurate list of the top 100 contemporary worship songs. And every year they publish this list. So I went through that list of top 100 contemporary worship songs and tried to figure out what percentage of our contemporary worship reflects lament versus celebration. Now, how many of you say, just like in the Bible, 40% of our top 100 contemporary worship songs are lament psalms that talk about suffering? 40%? About 25% of our contemporary worship songs are songs about suffering and songs about lament. About 20%? 15%? 10%? I think anywhere from about 5 to 10 out of the top 100 contemporary worship songs talk about lament. Now, again, compare that to the Bible, it is much less than that. And of those 5 to 10 songs, I'm really using the word lament in the most generous terms imaginable. The song starts out, I cry out. Finally, a lament song. Finally. The rest of the song is, I cry out for joy. Ah, oh, I still have to keep it. There's so few lament songs. I still have to count it as a lament song. But even with those very generous categories, there are only about 5 to 10 out of our top 100 contemporary worship songs that would qualify as lament. And what this points towards is that in the American church, we are so caught up in a triumphalism, in a fix-it, victorious, let's-do-it attitude that we sometimes forget in the Bible, we encounter stories of pain. We encounter stories of suffering and struggle. And those stories need to be heard because they're in the Bible for a reason. So I want to introduce you to the Book of Lamentations. And I know not all of us have had a much encounter with the Book of Lamentations, so I'm going to give us the opportunity to at least read 3 verses of Lamentations together. So why don't we all stand? We're going to look on the screen, and verses 1 of chapter 1, 2, 3 of chapter 1 is going to show up, and we'll read that in unison together in the Book of Lamentations. Ready? How deserted lies the city, once so full of people. How like a widow is she, who once was great among the nations. She who was a queen among the provinces has now become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night. Tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers there is no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. After affliction and harsh labor, Judah has gone into exile. She dwells among the nations. She finds no resting place. All who pursue her have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. Let's leave that up. Take your seat. Now, Lamentations is a story about suffering. And the context of why Lamentations needed to be written is that the people of Israel were going through severe, deep suffering. Some of you know the whole story. In the Old Testament, we learn about Israel becoming a great nation under King David and King Solomon. Israel is considered a superpower during its time. It is this massive economic and military giant in the Near East at that time. So under David and Solomon, they had established themselves as a very wealthy, affluent, successful nation. But what we know is the rest of the story, those who followed after David and Solomon were not as godly, were not followers of Yahweh, were not faithful to worship of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And so Israel not only begins to slip away as a nation, that follow whether they follow Yahweh or not, but they also begin to kind of slowly collapse politically and militarily. So what we see in the nation of Israel at this particular time is that they had so disobeyed God, so dishonored Yahweh, and so far walked away from the worship of Yahweh and turned to idols, that God needs to bring judgment. In fact, if you look at the book of Isaiah and look at the book of Jeremiah, it is this kind of long litany of judgment against Israel for their sins. Now, Jeremiah has been said repeatedly, you're going to fall as a nation. And that is what happens. Israel, the northern part of Israel falls, the southern part of Israel falls, and the only thing left of this once great nation is the capital city of Jerusalem. The Babylonians come and want to conquer Jerusalem. They're on their way to conquer Egypt, but Jerusalem is kind of in their way. So they lay siege to it, and they totally devastate the city. They starve out the residents. They destroy the world around Jerusalem. And so these are brutal conquerors. In fact, they were so brutal that they decide not only to destroy the crops for the season, they salt the field so that nothing can grow on them for several generations. And so a land that had once been flowing with milk and honey has now become a barren desert and wasteland. And so Jerusalem is now wiped out. This once great nation, these once great people are wiped out. The Babylonians were very brutal about conquering them. So they took the intelligentsia, the leaders, the elders, all those who they deemed as able to rebuild Israel's society. And as he says here, they took them into exile. They took them away and sent them into Babylon. And that's, of course, where we encounter the story of Daniel and his friends. These were young men who had potential to rebuild Jerusalem. They were sent away. And the only ones left in Jerusalem were the women, the children, the sick, the lame, the blind, the elderly, those who they felt were the most marginalized of that society who had no power or authority to rebuild Jerusalem. So we're talking about a moment in Israel's history where there is this complete devastation. Jerusalem is wiped out. All hope for the future has been sent into exile, and the only ones left are the most oppressed and marginalized group within Israel society or Jerusalem society. Now, into this context, Jeremiah speaks. Into this context, Lamentations is written. And into this context, there are actually three potential responses. I'm going to focus on the first one. The three potential responses is one, run away and hide. Disengage with the culture around it and say, we're done with you. The second is to give in to the people that have conquered you and say, we're just going to do what the rest of the world does. The third option is to enter into a moment and a time of lament. I don't have time to get into the second option, but we're going to look at the first and the third one. Let's look at that first option that the people of God have, which is the world around them is changing. They feel devastated. They feel that everything is falling apart. This is too much to handle. And one option is to run away and hide. But that option is said, you don't have that option, in Jeremiah 29, verses 4 through 7. This is what the Lord Almighty says to those I carried into exile. Build houses, settle down, plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. So remember this context. Jeremiah is writing to the exiles in Babylon. They're in the worst situation imaginable. The whole life has fallen apart. Too many changes occurring around them. And yet Yahweh says through Jeremiah, you are not allowed to give up. Even in the midst of the most wicked place imaginable, Babylon, you are to continue to persevere. You are not allowed to give up. That's why it says in verse 7, seek the peace. Now, almost every other time in the Bible, you see the phrase, seek the peace. What city is associated with it? Seek the peace of Jerusalem. Yeah, almost every other time in the Bible, you see, seek the peace and prosperity of Jerusalem. Except here it says, seek the peace and prosperity, not of Jerusalem, but of Babylon. Of all places to seek the peace of. The most wicked city imaginable. The city that represents everything that is the opposite of Jerusalem. And God says, even if you're in the most horrible, difficult, challenging place, you still are not allowed to give up. God's people do not have the option of giving up. Even if the world is crumbling around us, even if we can't handle all the changes and challenges around us, we do not have the option as God's people to run away and hide. And that's why Jeremiah says to the exiles, you're not going to do that. That is not an option for the people of God. Now let's bring this biblical truth to a historical reality. The sad part is, as a person who studies history, is to notice that in church history, the church has actually not been very good at this command that we see in Jeremiah. We've been very good at running away and hiding, but we are not very good at standing around and saying we are going to represent the word of God, the truth of God. We have had a history in the church, in fact, and I would argue particularly in the American church, of running away and hiding when challenges and changes and difficult situations arise. Let's look at a quick example of this. This is most evident when we look at from the 17th to the 20th century in the history of the church in America. Early in church history in the United States, there was this perception of the New World, the American continent, as a city set on a hill. This was the New Jerusalem. And as immigrants came from Western Europe and from England and from Netherlands, they were bringing this hope that the New World, the American continent, North America, was going to be that New Jerusalem. And that narrative held, this positive view, especially of cities, especially of the American continent, that positive view held from the 17th, 18th, into the 19th century. But it begins to change in the 19th century because America begins to change in the 19th century. So prior to the 19th century, people were defining the United States by Western and Northern European immigrants. But in the 19th and 20th century, you start getting not Northern and Western European immigrants, but Southern and Eastern European immigrants. And Northern and Western European immigrants were Protestants, and Southern and Eastern Europeans were Catholics and Orthodox Christians and Jews. And so all of a sudden, in these urban centers that had once been seen as cities set on a hill, when you start getting Italian Catholics and Polish Jews and Slavic Orthodox, they are no longer cities on a hill that is the New Jerusalem. They began to be portrayed as Babylon. And the cities are no longer Jerusalem, but they are now considered to be Babylon. Around the same time in the 19th and 20th century, a similar thing occurs where there is an influx, not just of Eastern and Southern Europeans, but an influx, especially in the northern cities, of African Americans. Post-Civil War, after Emancipation Proclamation, the movement of African Americans from the southern states, where most African Americans were in slavery, once there is the freedom that comes after the Civil War, they start moving away from the south into northern cities, like Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, etc., etc. All these Midwestern and Northeastern cities has an influx of African Americans into these urban centers. These two factors combined together, a non-Protestant European immigration and an African-American migration, makes Protestant Western Europeans in these urban centers in the East Coast and the Midwest very nervous. They don't know how to deal with these changes. They don't know how to deal with a changing neighborhood. And so they begin to talk about, our cities are not safe. Our cities are scary. Our schools are in decline. Our real estate prices are going down. We need to run away and hide. And so many of white Protestants ran away and hid in the suburbs of Philadelphia, in the suburbs of Chicago, in the exurbs and sub-rural communities outside of New York, outside of Boston, outside of Washington, D.C. And so we have a history of running away and hiding when things begin to change around us. One of the ways we know that it was not just kind of the larger society, but the churches in particular that ran away and hid is Winthrop Hudson's work on how much money was spent on new buildings. In 1945, the amount of money spent on new buildings was $26 million in the entire United States. Now, some churches, that's what they spend on one building these days. But in the entire United States, $26 million was spent on new buildings. From 1945 to 1960 is kind of the height of the white flight. People leaving the urban communities and moving into the suburbs. So that by 1960, the amount of money spent on new building goes up to $1 billion. Think about the increase in building money that's being spent. Why? Because people are leaving the city and these huge buildings in the cities and moving out to the suburbs and spending money on new buildings in the suburbs. Now, there's something I noticed about the buildings that were built in the 50s and 60s during this time of flight from the city and running away into the suburbs. If you go to the next slide, many of the church buildings that were built in the 50s and 60s have a sanctuary with a ceiling that looks like this, kind of a slanted roof with a little bit of an arch on the side. If you've been to a more traditional church that was built in the 50s and 60s, you've seen sanctuaries like this. How many of you have seen sanctuaries and buildings that look like this? Now, I was about 11 years old in the 70s, and my church had just built a building that looked like this. And even as an 11-year-old, I knew this is not a good idea. This is a really stupid building. Why? Because I lived in a cold weather climate area. The building was being dedicated in January and February. And when you have ceilings like this on a cold day when the heating vents are on the floor, where does all that wonderful warm air go? Right up into the rafters. And you literally have the frozen chosen on the ground and all this wonderful warm air up in the ceiling. And then you have to build ceiling fans to push the hot air down, and then charismatics can't worship with you because they keep hitting their hands on the ceilings when they lift their hands. So you developed a church architecture that really doesn't make sense. It's kind of inefficient and to have this kind of ceiling. So I was thinking, even as an 11-year-old at my building's dedication, whose stupid idea was this to build the building to look like this? I know as an 11-year-old, this is a bad idea. The senior pastor gets up there and says, it was my idea to build the building to look like this. And he says, I want you to imagine the entire church building turned upside down. Imagine the building turned upside down, and what do you see? And he said, you're looking at the bottom of a boat, of a ship. Do you see how that looks like the bottom of a ship? And he said, we intentionally build the church to look like the bottom of a boat, a bottom of a ship, because we believe that our church is Noah's Ark. Now think with me, what you are saying to the world when you say your church is Noah's Ark. You are safe in Noah's Ark. You've got your kind of cultural and social and religious life on Noah's Ark, but you really don't care about what's going out on in the world out there. As long as you're safe in Noah's Ark with your kind of microcosm of the world, you've got your Christian music, you've got your Christian art, you've got your Christian t-shirts, your Christian coloring books, your Christian underwear, you name it, we've got a Christian version of it. And so you end up being safe in Noah's Ark, but how do you relate to the world out there? You actually don't. How do you do evangelism out of Noah's Ark? Well, not very well. Because here's what happens when you're doing evangelism out of Noah's Ark. You're on the Ark, and you see Uncle Joe float by. Of course you love Uncle Joe. He's family. Get that life raft and bring Uncle Joe onto the Ark. We love you, Uncle Joe. We're glad you're here. We're glad you're safe in the flood waters. Great. Uncle Joe's on board. But then you see a neighbor float by. And you say, oh, wait a minute now. He borrowed my mower about a week ago, hasn't given it back. So I'm not sure. But you know what's more important? He's different from us. We have a particular culture on this Ark. We do things in a particular way. We like foods that are maybe not as spicy as that guy might like it. We only packed one bottle of sriracha sauce, and that's just not going to handle it for this guy. He's going to want more than one bottle. You know, we like mayonnaise on our food, and he's not going to like as much mayonnaise on his food. It's just going to be a challenge. You know, we clap on 1-3, he claps on 2-4. It's just not going to be easy to have him on this Ark. So maybe there's another Ark down the street that's more fitting for his kind of culture. And so we create a little subculture on Noah's Ark that makes it very difficult to meet people that are different from us, that have a different perspective or life from us. And so we have built a building, an architecture, that reflects the values of a subculture community rather than actually being a witness for the kingdom of God in the world. Now, I raise this. Again, this is kind of a historical reality that occurred from about 1850 to about the 1970s. But there's a new reality that has occurred. The urban-suburban stuff has kind of gone by the wayside. But there's a new challenge and new changes that are occurring in our society in the 21st century. And it has a lot to do with not only the changing demographics of the city, but the changing demographics of American society as a whole. In 1965, there was a change in the immigration laws in the United States. And since 1965, little bit by little bit, there's been kind of a year-to-year incremental legal immigration into the United States. And so you get folks over this past 50-plus years such as myself. My family came to the United States in 1973. We followed the procedure of coming in through Seattle and coming in with a green card. We went through that whole process. And so from 65 forward, when the laws changed, the laws did not throw open the gates of immigration. It just said we're not going to limit immigration to Europeans anymore. We're going to actually allow immigrants to come from Asia, Latin America, and Africa. Prior to 1965, there were specific laws that said we don't want certain people to come to the U.S. The first of these was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. Can anybody guess what that did? Yes, it excluded Chinese people. It was not very subtle about it. It was very clear. We did the Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese people. There were a number of laws like this that said we're going to specifically say we don't want certain people, particularly from Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And so most of the immigration prior to 1965 would have been European immigration. But post-1965, it doesn't change the number of immigrants necessarily, but it changes the shape and distribution of the pie. And so now more immigrants are coming from Asia, Latin America, and from Africa. So that by 2008, a third of the U.S. population is already of non-European descent. So that by 2011, half the births in America are now of non-European descent. The number I didn't have on here is that by last year, in the year 2016, the incoming kindergarten class had a majority non-European class. And that makes sense because 5 years earlier, half the births were of non-European descent, and 5 years later, the incoming kindergarten class is now of non-European descent, majority. By 2023, half of all the children under the age of 18 will be of non-European descent. And by 2042, half of all of America will be of non-European descent. So we're talking about a changing demographic. And to know that the changing demographic is not related to immigration per se anymore. It's tied to birth rates. It's about birth rates. And so no matter how big of a wall China builds for us in the border of Mexico, it's actually not going to change this reality. Because it's tied to birth rates, not to immigration patterns. In other words, America is becoming diverse. This is a reality we have to deal with. This is a change we have to deal with. And actually, what I was saying yesterday during our workshop is that the change in demographics in America is actually saving American Christianity rather than diminishing Christianity. Because the immigrants that are coming are Korean Presbyterians, are Spanish-speaking Pentecostals, are bringing Christian faith and supporting Christian ministries here in the United States. Now, the question is, in the midst of all these changes, the demographic changes in our society, and most of you already have seen this in your neighborhood schools and in the area surrounding areas of Philadelphia, within the midst of demographic changes, are you going to run away and hide? Or are you going to see the move of God in the middle of these changes? Are you going to be like the people of Israel who have to be told, you can't run away and hide when changes occur? This is the time to rise up and say, I will be a conduit of the kingdom of God, not to hide away in Noah's Ark, but to actually rise up to say, this is what God's people have been called to be the reconcilers. To be the ones who builds bridges across the racial and cultural divide. We don't have the option as the people of God to run away and hide. Now, I'll leave you with a final challenge. One thing about the book of Jeremiah is that Jeremiah, there's questions about whether Jeremiah wrote the book of Lamentations or not. He is probably the best candidate to have written the book of Jeremiah. The Book of Lamentations, mainly because, as I said, all the literate, the leaders, those who could read or write, those who were scholars, they were all kind of sent away into exile. Jeremiah, in his writings, advocated that Jerusalem given to the Babylonians. So the Babylonians thought he was on their side. So he's probably one of the very few, if not the only person, who could read or write who was left behind in Jerusalem. Because the Babylonians thought he was on their side. So in terms of the candidate to actually write the book of Lamentations, Jeremiah is the best candidate. But scholars compare the book of Jeremiah to the book of Lamentations and find out, wow, that's very different styles of writing. It's like Shakespeare and Tupac. They're both literature, but it's very different styles of writing. So you got Jeremiah and you've got Lamentations. And they're saying there's no way that Jeremiah also wrote both Jeremiah and Lamentations. Well, here's the problem. What happens in the book of Lamentations is that Jeremiah goes to the town square, the city gate actually, and that's where the people gather. And all those that are broken and hurting and have suffered under this siege, they start coming out and they start telling their stories. And Jeremiah starts writing it down. And so Lamentations is not in his voice. He might have done the writing of it, but he's really telling the story of the people. He's letting all the voices be heard, the most suffering. Now, he's privileged. He's a prophet. He's a leader. He can read and write, all of these things. He's privileged, but his voice is not the voice that is being heard. He is reflecting the voice of the broken, the suffering. I actually argue that Lamentations might be the most feminine book of the Bible because it really reflects the voices of women that have suffered in the midst of these tremendous challenges. And so what we see in the book of Lamentations is Jeremiah intentionally representing all of the voices in order to engage the fullness of lament. And that's my challenge to you. In a triumphalistic world, lament is desperately needed. But if you're going to do lament right, you need to hear all of the voices. You need to hear not only the success stories, but the stories of pain. You need to not only hear stories of triumph, but the stories of suffering. You need to not only hear stories from your own communities, but also the voices of other communities. I'll give you two examples of this. The first is adoption. My friend who pastors in the south side of Chicago, a white couple, wanted to adopt an African-American child. So they were sent to a place where they had to be trained to adopt to do this adoption. So they were given a clear bowl, and then in the middle of the table were all these different colored marbles. And they were asked to fill their clear bowl with the color that corresponded to the question. So the questions were, the last 10 books that you've read, who is the author? The last 5 people you've invited into your home, what race and ethnicity were they? The type of furniture you have in your home, what culture does it represent? The last 5 songs you sang, the 10 people that are in your small group. And you just kind of go down the list and ask the questions, what have you surrounded yourself with? And my friend, who's a very, aware and thoughtful pastor in the south side of Chicago, found that his bowl was filled with white marbles because he has surrounded his world with voices from the European and European American community. So there was all white marbles. And the question was, now take the color of the child you're about to adopt and put it in the middle of that clear bowl. So you have 50 white marbles and 1 black marble at the top of all these white marbles. So are you hearing all of the voices? Are you hearing the voices of the African-American community? Are you hearing the stories of the Latino immigrant? Are you hearing the stories of the Korean-American immigrant? Are you hearing all of the stories so that all of the voices are helping you to engage this powerful practice of lament? The second example is the story of my mother. As was mentioned, I came to the U.S. when I was a child. My father, who brought us to the United States, actually several years later after coming to the U.S., left our family, just kind of disappeared and left us. And my mom, who has a high school education but doesn't have a college education, essentially had to do whatever she could to keep our family together. She worked from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. In Baltimore City, working at an inner city carryout, making steak sandwiches and fish specials and frying chicken and all the stuff that you do at an inner city carryout. She worked from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And then she would rush to her night job. It was an overnight job where she worked from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. at a night shift as a nurse's aide in a nursing home in inner city Baltimore. And then she would rush home so that she can be home in time to wake up her kids, feed us breakfast, send us off. She would then sleep for 2 to 3 hours and then rush back to her day job. And she did this 6 days a week, 20 hours a day. And on Sunday, she kept the Sabbath and would go to church and would be a deacon at the church and would help cook for the elders of that church. And she would spend the whole day serving the pastors of that church, serving the elders of that church. She set an example for us of what it means to sacrifice everything for her family, to work 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, so she could keep our family together, so that she can give educational opportunities for her 4 children. And every one of us is in Christian ministry in some form. Every one of us is in some form of Christian education or Christian ministry. And that was the example set to us by our mother. But not only an example, but she also set a spiritual setting for us as a family. She's now in her 80s, but when she was in her 60s, she showed me the condition of her knees. Most of us have 1 kneecap on each knee. She has a kneecap that is in 5 different pieces on each knee. Because every day she would pray for an hour, kneeling on a hardwood floor. And when you pray like that, an hour or 2 a day on a hardwood floor, day after day after day, your knees can't take that kind of pressure. So her kneecaps cracked into 5 different pieces. So that now when she kneels to pray, her kneecaps shape to conform to the shape of the floor. Her kneecaps open up so that she can kneel before God. And she's been doing this for decades. And now that she's in her 80s, she's in the stages, early stages of dementia and Alzheimer's. And I think about, why hasn't her voice been heard? Why hasn't that example been the example we say, this is what Christianity is about? I don't want to hear another pastor tell me to reach for the stars because the sky's the limit. I want to hear the lament of moms and grandmoms, of grandparents who have spent their entire life praying for the church on their knees, lifting up a lament. My friends, when you're in this struggle and this challenge, stay on your knees. Continue to pray. Do not give up. Persevere and hear all the voices that are lifted up in lament together for the sake of the gospel. Lord, I thank you that this church is a courageous church. It is a church that will not walk away from a difficult challenge, will not walk away from the places that are challenging and difficult, because, Lord, you set a path for them. I pray that in this season of wonderful, wonderful exploration and learning, you would continue to give this courage to persevere. And I pray that not only will there be a sense of triumph in this church, there will also be the understanding of lament. Let all the voices of your kingdom, let all the voices of your church be heard, that we might enter into both the victory praise, but also the lament of the suffering. For we pray this in your name. Amen.